of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A sigh of relief for the Pakistani Prime Minister. The country's National Assembly reposed trust in Prime Minister Imran Khan in a vote of confidence. Prime Minister Khan himself sought the vote of confidence from the National Assembly after the government-backed candidate lost to an opposition leader in a Senate election. The defeat of the country's finance minister had raised questions whether the government commanded majority of the parliament. After winning the vote of confidence, Prime Minister Khan made it clear that he would not give any relief to opposition leaders facing corruption cases.
Mr. Zardari has been proven corrupt. He is known as Mr. 10%. On the other hand, Nawaz Sharif, after plundering the national wealth, has fled abroad. I will not give them any amnesty, come what may.
While inside the parliament, members were congratulating the Prime Minister, outside, government and opposition members were clashing with each other. The ruling party workers attacked the senior opposition leaders when they were holding press conference. Opposition parties condemned the violence. But Prime Minister Khan's supporters were jubilant for his success.
These people have not come here on Prime Minister Imran Khan's call. He has not given any official call. These are people who came here spontaneously. We decided ourselves. It's a grassroots movement. We decided that we'll come here to show our support for Imran Khan.
While Khan's supporters defend his performance, opposition thinks the country's economic situation has deteriorated under the current government. Prime Minister Imran Khan may have won the vote of confidence from the parliament, but observers believe his trouble is far from over. Amid economic and other challenges, major opposition parties are planning to march towards the capital later this month to seek his ouster. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Voices of Divinity. These ear-soothing voices narrate divine verses from the Holy Book of Quran. The recitations come as part of the 37th International Quran Competition, based in Iran. 57 finalists from 26 countries are competing in the annual contest, which was held online this year due to the pandemic.
This year, the contestants sent us recordings of their recitations. Those recitations then are broadcast live on the IRIB Quran channel, and the judgment is carried out by our selected jury members at the same time. This is a brand new style in holding the competition. All other similar Quranic events are cancelled as a result of the pandemic.
411 participants from 67 countries took part in the primary stage of the competition. 122 contestants made it to the semi-final stage. Participants compete in three different fields of recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Listening to the verses of the Quran through the beautiful voice of Quran reciters gives you better peace and spirituality. Such recitations permeate the depths of your heart and connect you to God. That is why the tradition of recitation is still extant today and has many followers.
There is a verse in the Holy Quran that says, "Verily, in the remembrance of God do hearts find rest." And the reading or reciting the divine verses of the Holy Book truly makes you remember your Creator and help you find peace.
The Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization, which organizes the Quranic event, says the motto of this year's edition is One Book, One Ummah. It says the ultimate goal of the event is to unite the Muslim community based on the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran.
Not all Muslims can recite the Holy Book of Quran as perfectly as contestants here do. But every Muslim family has the Holy Book in their houses to read it and ponder the messages embedded in its verses. Messages that Muslims here say boil down to this key instruction: follow the path of righteousness. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Nigerian government has described the commencement of this vaccination exercise of Nigerians as a historic moment in the fight against the COVID-19. The kickoff of the vaccination followed the delivery of close to 4 million doses of the COVAX AstraZeneca vaccines to Nigeria on 2nd March 2021. Nigerian health officials said the delay in the start of the vaccination was to ensure that the vaccines were checked for safety.
The vaccines that we're going to be delivering today to Nigerians are safe, they're effective, and we're going to roll out this vaccine in a very efficient manner, just like we all work together as one country and defeated the white polio viruses. Today, it feels proud to be a Nigerian. All of you should be proud.
The Nigerian government said Nigerians should support the planned and systematic rollout of the vaccines and mobilize citizens for the vaccination exercise. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, played an important role in the arrival of the vaccines and says the successful battle against the COVID-19 will impact positively on routine immunization of Nigerian children against the other preventable childhood killer diseases.
UNICEF was the organization that did the procurement and the delivery of those vaccines on the 2nd of March. And we're very, very pleased that today we're able to administer them. But also now the challenge is getting them to the states, and the states starting to vaccinate the health, the frontline workers, the health workers, so that they can be protected as quickly as is possible.
This medical doctor becomes the first Nigerian at this occasion to be given the COVID-19 vaccination. He has been a frontline health worker since March 2020. And has lost his father to the COVID-19. 158,000 Nigerians have so far been infected with the COVID-19, and over 1,900 have died of the disease. The World Health Organization has stated that the vaccines have undergone rigorous regulatory processes at global and country level and have been certified safe and effective. The next challenge for Nigerian health officials is how to reach millions of Nigerians in remote rural communities. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Anti-monarchy activists showed up at the headquarters of Spain's car manufacturer SEAT in the north of Barcelona to protest a visit by King Felipe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. Protesters shouted slogans against the monarch and held banners reading "Catalonia has no king," 1 week after violent riots shook the region over the imprisonment of a rapper for insulting Spanish royals.
The rejection of the Spanish monarchy has become a recurrent theme with every royal visit to Catalonia over the past years. Here are some of the grievances with regard to this particular visit to the car factory.
The King of Spain will never be welcome in Catalonia. The King of the October 3rd speech, the King who 3.5 years ago called business owners to urge them to relocate their headquarters out of Catalonia, is not welcome.
The Spanish government Thursday announced it will dedicate part of the Coronavirus European Recovery Fund to launch an electric car battery plant with SEAT's parent company, Volkswagen. But trade unions say the transition towards a greener economy requires transparent labor reforms and should not overlook basic rights.
We need to know how the European Recovery Fund is going to be spent. We believe it should be entirely put under public administration. The investments in the car industry should be in compliance with public interest first, and that includes taking into account the reduction of the average working hours in view of the increasing automation.
The automotive industry in Spain generates nearly 2 million direct and indirect jobs. It represents 10% of the GDP and 19% of total exports. Declining sales and extended shutdowns due to the coronavirus pandemic have forced Japanese car maker Nissan last year to shut down one of its three plants in Catalonia. Kasai Kadri, Barcelona.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The qualities of the people of Azerbaijan that helped create the 29th of Behman event. Another characteristic is the important role played by outstanding personalities. There are many personalities in this area who played a leading role in all the matters of the country. They are unforgettable personalities. I will tell you that we should not let this glorious history be consigned to oblivion. This history should be preserved. Undoubtedly, without a correct analysis of the history of Azerbaijan, every analysis of the history of Iran is incomplete and defective. Those who are experts and who are enthusiastic should embark on presenting a correct analysis of the issues of Azerbaijan. These were a few short points about Azerbaijan and Tabriz.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
As for the 29th of Behman of 1356, after that event, Imam issued a message in which he cited three characteristics of the dear people of Tabriz. The word dear also existed in the message issued by Imam. The dear people of Azerbaijan. He mentioned three characteristics: courage, zeal, and piety. Our magnanimous Imam mentioned these three characteristics in his message to Azerbaijan. All three characteristics are really important criteria for evaluating a group of people and assessing their activities and endeavors. Courage, zeal, and piety, in the right place and right time. When the people of Tabriz staged an uprising, in my opinion, this is an important point which should receive attention. They had already seen the 19th of Dey event in Qom. They have already seen how savagely the regime entered the arena to kill the people. And the regime thought that it had managed to take away the people's courage from them after the Qom incident, and that no one would dare to enter the arena.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Tatwi. Israel has once again threatened Iran with military action, a threat that is against international law. Iran says it will respond in kind if attacked, that it could raise Tel Aviv and Haifa after Israel has threatened updating attacks, its attack plans on Iran. Why is Israel, which has hundreds of nuclear warheads, threatened Iran, which is not after nuclear weapons? What about the U.S. role, which has also used the infamous all options on the table against Iran? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of the debate.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the 1979 victory of the Islamic Revolution, which toppled the regime of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Over the past years, Israel has also threatened military action against Iran, accusing Tehran of seeking to obtain a nuclear weapon. The latest anti-Iran rhetoric came from Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, who said the regime is updating its plans for striking Iran's nuclear sites.
Recently, the Chief of Staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible.
His remarks drew a strong reaction from Iranian officials.
Israel knows. But if it doesn't, it should know that if it does a damn thing, we will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa to the ground.
Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations also turned the spotlight on the threat posed by Israel's clandestine nuclear weapons program.
The development of a clandestine nuclear weapons program by Israel poses a continuing serious threat not only to the security and the stability of the region and the world, but also to the effectiveness and efficiency of the NPT and the IAEA's safeguards regime.
Israel accuses Iran of seeking nuclear weapons without providing any evidence. The allegation comes as Iran's nuclear activities are monitored by the International Atomic Energy Agency. However, Israel is believed to be the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region with hundreds of nuclear warheads. It has also refused to allow any inspection of its nuclear facilities or join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Experts say Israel seeks to demonize Iran as a nuclear threat to go the United States into a military confrontation with the Islamic Republic.
What they're saying is that we're reviewing our strategy on targeting Iranian nuclear facilities. So they're saying basically that we're prepared to go to war, we're prepared to act unilaterally and go to war with Iran, or basically cause a war that will drag the U.S. with us into Iran.
Nonetheless, Iran says it is not one to get engaged in a war, but will not hesitate to defend itself in the face of any foreign aggression.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, joins us from New York. We also have activist and political commentator Leith Maarouf, who joins us from Beirut. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Daniel Lazar. This threat by Israel, by the Minister of Military Affairs, saying that Israel was updating plans for military strikes on the Iran nuclear sites, and one of the reasons stated, in case Tehran continues what he characterized as nuclear escalation. So that's about a third of his threats. Let me get your reaction on this part of his threat.
Well, I think it's clear that the Iran is that the real target is the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the formal name of the 2015 Iran Nuclear Accord, which Israel is doing its best to destroy. Are intense behind-the-scenes debates going on in Washington over whether to re-enter negotiations for a renewal of the treaty. But Israel is clearly taking part in those debates by virtue of updating and publicizing its plans to strike at Israel, strike at Iran. So these military strikes are, in a sense, aimed at the U.S. as much as they are at Iran. And so that's what's going on here. Israel is upping the ante. It wants to kill the JCPOA. It wants to strengthen its allies in Washington to force them to do the same by putting pressure on the Biden administration. And I think that's what's going on here. So Israel is definitely engaging in kind of a war of propaganda and a kind of a show of nerves.
Well, Leith Maarouf, Benny Gantz, was asked about Iran's nuclear program in an interview and whether Israel was completing preparations to attack Iranian targets, in which he said, quote, we have them, the plans in our hands, and of course, but we will continue constantly improving them. And he said that it's not going to be completed until we actually conduct the strikes. Does that sound to you like they are targeting the JCPOA or that they are targeting Iran?
Well, they are definitely targeting the JCPOA more than Iran, because if apartheid Israel had the ability to attack Iran, he would have done it already. We know the enemy is brazing with their violations of international law and are willing, just like the United States, to breach international law and commit the most heinous crime, which is a crime of aggression, a war of aggression that is unauthorized by the Security Council, as it happened in Iraq in 2003. So we know that apartheid Israel, if it had the power to do so, it would have done so. But the problem that is facing the whole empire and its vassal apartheid Israel is that even the United States doesn't have the capabilities to withstand a war with Iran that will drag the whole region and probably the world to a steamrolling situation that nobody can control. Yes, apartheid Israel has nuclear weapons it can threaten. The United States has nuclear weapons, and Biden just sent today two B-52s to fly to the region, again with nuclear weapons. But can they deliver on that? and can they withstand the reaction that is impossible?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. I'm not too sure who's going to get the question on that, but I'm going to expand a little bit more on this threat by Israel, if I may, with you, Daniel Lazar. Benny Gantz saying, quote, the Iranian nuclear escalation must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good, but if not, we must stand independently, and we must defend ourselves by ourselves. Now, that's what Benny Gantz has said. I'm going to now put also what Iran has said in terms of its threat. The defense minister, Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel commits any mistake. Iran's leader has said in the past the Zionist regime is not our main enemy, and they know. And if they don't, they should know that the Islamic Republic will level Tel Aviv and Haifa to the ground if they do something wrong. These are pretty strong words coming as a reaction to what Israel has said. Do you still think that this is something that Israel is targeting, namely the JCPOA?
Well, yes, I do, because the JCPOA essentially would have stopped the Iranian nuclear program in its tracks, for better or for worse. But Israel was unhappy with the JCPOA back in 2015, just as it is today. So really, it's in a sense, its complaint, its target is the JCPOA. But in another sense, in a larger sense, it's really seeking regime change in Iran itself. It wants to topple the Islamic State. So therefore, I mean, Iran is quite correct in seeing a threat to its very identity, to its very government, to its very Republican status, Therefore, it's understandable that it would respond, you know, it would promise to respond in kind to Israel by raising Tel Aviv and Haifa. Whether it could accomplish that is another question, of course. But yes, I mean, I think that Israel is definitely engaged in a change operation and won't be happy until the Islamic Republic is destroyed.
Okay. Leif Baruf, our guest there, said whether Iran can accomplish that or not. It was maybe 3 or 4 seconds of a few words put together there by him. Let's expand on that a little bit so there's no doubts in this regard. And I'd like to ask you, Leif Maruf, we saw what happened to the Ayn al-Assad air base in retaliation to the assassination of Iran's top general, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. We saw what happened there. There's also Iran's allies in the region, namely Hezbollah, to name one. Do you think that there are any doubts about if Iran was attacked, how it would retaliate?
Of course not. And to be very clear, not only did we see the footage of the attack on Ayn al-Assad, but we have also seen the attacks delivered in retaliation by Ansarullah, the government in Yemen, and the resistance on Saudi targets. Including just yesterday on the main ports of export of Saudi oil in the Aramco Bay, you know, port in the eastern of the Saudi-occupied area. So we have very clear situation. We know also that apartheid Israel has been trying for years now to be able to attack Hezbollah in Lebanon. And we've seen the result. There is an actual balance of deterrence between Hezbollah, a militia of only around 60,000 fighters, and apartheid Israel, the most armed nation in the world with the highest tech of the imperial forces. So what we have is just bluster, and we know that Iran actually is the one that can deliver on the threat, and that the only thing that is currently stopping a retaliation on apartheid Israel directly is that the axis of resistance is the one that is not looking for more death in the region. We are seeing over the last few years how restrained actually the resistance axis led by Iran has been to the violations of international law, and how they've played really well that strategic restraint.
Okay. Well, Daniel Lazar, I'd like to ask you if you saw the most recent release. It was about a week or 10 days ago of the attack that took place on the Ayn al-Assad airbase by Iran, and the recounts and the testimony that was given by some of the U.S. Personnel that were there. I'm wondering if you saw that and the statements that they made, and so if you believe that whether Iran is capable or not of its threat, counter threat to what Israel has said in terms of Haifa and Tel Aviv.
Oh, I saw that. I saw the footage. Yes, and it was a very impressive display. You know, the missile fire was very accurate, and there is no question that that missile technology has been raised to a very high level, and that therefore Iran and its allies in the Middle East, principally Hezbollah, would constitute a very powerful force against Israel. I wouldn't write the Israelis off either, because the Israelis have shown great military capability. So I really would hate to see the region go down that route. I mean, I don't want to see a general war break out in the Middle East, because I think it will cause immense damage, huge amounts of deaths, endless suffering. It would be a real tragedy. So I would like to see a military conflict avoided. But of course, the U.S. In its own ways, is aiding the most hardline elements against Iran, and therefore making more likely such a confrontation.
Yeah, let's talk about, we need to expand a little bit more here, Leif Maruf, if we can, about the relationship between Biden and also Netanyahu. I mean, at this point, it is pretty obvious, Israel has made it obvious, that it is against the U.S. entering or re-entering the JCPOA. It has made that obvious to the point that it has made a military threat again when Biden obviously said the things that he said, not only on his campaign trail, but also recently. But the show of the B-52 bombers that the U.S. displayed with Israel escorting them, what is the message that's being sent there by the U.S. in terms of the military threat overall by Israel on Iran?
It's actually a message of weakness, signaling the weakness of the United States in the region. If the United States has the only threat that it can provide to Iran to deter resistance in the region is nuclear holocaust, then the United States is tacitly admitting that it cannot do anything with less than that. If the United States enter traditional war with Iran without the use of nuclear weapons, the United States bases and its vessels in the Gulf and in apartheid Israel will be decimated like never before. So 100 years of buildup of colonial and imperial projection in the region will be eradicated off the face of Earth. Does that mean that Iran will not also be destroyed, or more, you know, people in the Arabic world will not be killed by apartheid Israel and the empire? Of course they will. But that, in the end of it, if such a conflict starts, it will mean the exit of imperial projection from the region for the first time since the end of World War I, at a high price. But ultimately, it's a higher price for the empire than the people questing liberation from it.
Well, Daniel Lazar, this whole thing about the JCPOA that Israel is against, this Iran nuclear deal, I mean, you would think that was something that Israel should want and entertain and receive warmly. But it has pushed back, as you mentioned. We can never forget when they showed up in Congress, Netanyahu, when he showed up in Congress in the U.S., that hasn't been seen in a while. Trying to make sure that Barack Obama didn't enter into that deal. But yet, it has always pushed back on it. It has made military threats. Do you think that there are gains that Israel makes by there not being a deal? For example, getting the military aid that it gets from the U.S. to the tune of over $3 or $4 billion, I forget the dollar amount. And, of course, the U.S. sales of weapons overall when it comes to this hypothetical Iran threat?
Well, first of all, Israel does make gains. I mean, the balance of power in the Middle East, contrary to what Leith says, has shifted in Israel's favor over the last half century, dramatically in its favor. I mean, the Lebanese economy is in ruins. Syria is doing extremely badly. Iraq is a basket case. Iran itself is under economic siege. And Israel is economically highly resilient. Its military is as strong as ever. And I don't think that plunging the region into a general conflagration, it's very easy to call from that, from the safety of Montreal. But I don't think it's good for the Middle Eastern masses, regardless of religion, whether they're Muslim, Christian, or Jewish. I think that is a path to perdition. So yes, Israel does reap certain advantages, and yes, the axis of resistance has wound up defeating itself more than it has defeated the Israeli state.
Lech Maruf, I'll let you answer that. Go ahead.
I mean, I'm shocked to hear such analysis, because clearly Israel is at its weakest point in its 100 years of as a project. Clearly, all the tools and vessels of the empire have been exposed openly, that have been working 100 years in collaboration against Arab liberation and liberation of Western Asia and North Africa in general. We've seen every war since 1973, apartheid Israel has lost, and we're talking here about the occupation of Lebanon, 2006 war, the 2008, 2014 wars on Gaza. All of those were humongous defeats. Does that mean that Arab people are not suffering under the worst campaign of ethnic cleansing since the imperial rule in the region, with the rise of the Arab Autumn and the Wahhabi contra invasions that the Saudi occupied Arabia and apartheid Israel with the United States plotted against the region? Of course not. Yes, the Arabs are suffering. Yes, the Iranian people are suffering. But to tell you very clearly, today we are closer to the liberation of Jerusalem and Palestine than any day before since 1912.
Okay, I have time to squeeze in one more question. Daniel Lazar, do you think that there will be a nuclear deal? And if so, what will we see when it comes to Israel on that?
I don't believe there will be a nuclear deal. I think the JCPOA is essentially dying before our very eyes. And I think that that if it does indeed die, I think we will see an increasingly polarized situation in the Middle East and a greater chance of an all-out military conflict, which my colleague would welcome, but which I very much oppose.
Lech Maruf, same question to you. We do have a minute. Go ahead.
I definitely don't welcome war, and nobody who's sane wants war. But when your enemy is the one that's going to start the war, including if we just saw last week the lie about the supposed Israeli ship that was supposedly attacked in the Gulf, and now we saw today live broadcasted on Al-Maidin television the released footage from Iranian drones flying around the ship, showing actually that it was an inside job. It was an explosion from inside. So basically, apartheid Israel and Saudi occupied Arabia were trying to trigger a war by claims of attacks on an Israeli ship. So you have your enemy, our enemy, and the enemy of peace and the enemy of humanity, the Zionists, the Wahhabis, and the Americans that govern them, are the ones that are egging for war any way possible, and the people of the region have to be ready to defend themselves.
All right, thank you very much for that, Lech Maruf, activist and political commentator there from Beirut. Daniel Lazar, thank you so much, from New York, journalist and author. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Yikovit Tach, my entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. On
this sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry, and a lucrative one. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system, says Ramzi Barood, editor of Palestine Chronicle, in an article published under the heading "The American Injustice Industry: Why Shutting Down Guantanamo Is Not Enough." Stay tuned for the details, please. That's certainly our goal and our intention. This was the non-committal answer given by the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki when on February 12th, she was asked by a reporter whether the new Joe Biden administration intends to shut down the notorious Guantanamo Bay prison by the end of the president's first term in office. Psaki's answer may have seemed reassuring that the untold suffering experienced by hundreds of men in this American gulag, many of whom were surely innocent, would be finally coming to an end. However, considering the history of Guantanamo and the trail of broken promises by the Barack Obama administration, the new administration's pledge is hardly encouraging. Compare the new language with that of Obama's impassioned diatribes about humanity, justice, and American values, which he utilized whenever he spoke of Guantanamo. Gitmo has become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law, Obama said at a speech at the National Defense University in May 2013. Enamored with his every word, Obama's audience clapped with enthusiasm. When he delivered that particular speech, Obama was then serving his second term in office. He already had ample opportunity to shut down the prison, which operated with no international monitoring and entirely outside the realms of international and U.S. laws. Obama is likely to be remembered for his words, not his actions. Not only did he fail to shut down the prison which was erected by his predecessor, George W. Bush, in 2002, but the Guantanamo industry continued to thrive during his terms. For example, in his speech, Obama made reference to the high cost of $150 million each year to imprison 166 people. According to the New Yorker reporting in 2016, Guantanamo's budget had morphed to $445 million last year when Obama was still in office. Yet, as the budget grew by leaps and bounds, the number of Guantanamo prisons dwindled. Currently, there are only 40 prisoners still residing in that massive edifice of metal, concrete, and barbed wire located at the eastern tip of Cuba, built atop a piece of land leased by the U.S. in 1903. It is easy to conclude that the U.S. government keeps the prison open only to avoid international accountability and arguably to extract information by torture, an act that is inconsistent with American laws. But this cannot be it. On the one hand, the entire wars against Afghanistan and Iraq were illegal under international law. Such a fact hardly stopped the U.S. and its allies from savagely invading, humiliating and torturing entire populations with no regard whatsoever to legal and moral arguments. On the other hand, Guantanamo is merely one of many American-run prisons and detention centers throughout the world that operate with no manual of rules and according to the most ruthless tactics. The tragedy of Abu Ghraib, a U.S. military detention center in Baghdad, only became famous when direct evidence of the degrading and incredibly violent conduct that was taking place within its walls was produced and publicized. In fact, many American officials and members of Congress at the time used the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004 as an opportunity to whitewash and rebrand American crimes elsewhere and to present the misconduct in this Iraqi prison as if an isolated incident involving a few bad apples. The few bad apples arguments made by G.W. Bush was more or less the same logic utilized by Obama when he championed the closure of Guantanamo. Indeed, both presidents insisted that neither Abu Ghraib nor Guantanamo should be made out to represent what America is really all about. Is this who we are, Obama? Animatedly and passionately asked as he made a case in favor of the closure of Guantanamo, speaking as if a human rights advocate, not a commander-in-chief who had direct authority to shut down the entire facility. The truth is that Abu Ghraib tortures were not a few bad apples, and Guantanamo is indeed a microcosm of exactly what the U.S. is or has become. From Bagram, Afghanistan, to Abu Ghraib, Iraq, to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to the many floating prisons, news of which was leaked by U.S. media in 2014, the U.S. government continues to make a mockery of international and humanitarian laws. Many American officials who genuinely advocate the closure of Guantanamo refuse to acknowledge that the prison is a symbol of their country's intransigence and refuse to accept that, like any other country in the world, it is accountable to international law. This lack of accountability has exceeded the U.S. government's insistence to act alone, as in to launch wars without international mandates. One U.S. administration after another has also made it clear that under no circumstances would they allow accused war criminals to be investigated, let alone stand trial, before the International Criminal Court, ICC. The message here is that even America's bad apples can potentially walk free regardless of the heinousness of their crimes. Just months after the Trump administration imposed sanctions on the ICC judges to punish them for the potential investigations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, it freed the convicted criminals who carried out horrific crimes in Iraq. On December 22nd, Trump pardoned four American mercenaries who belonged to the private military firm Blackwater. These convicted murderers were involved in the killing of 14 civilians, including two children, in Baghdad in 2007. What became known as the Nisour Square Massacre was another example of whitewashing, as government officials and mainstream media, though expressing outrage at the unlawful killing, insisted that the massacre was an isolated episode. The fact that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, mostly civilians, were killed as a result of American invasion seems irrelevant in the country's skewed logic in its never-ending war on terror. Whether Biden fulfills his promise of shutting down Guantanamo or not, little will change if the U.S. remains committed to its condescending attitude towards international law and to its undeserved view of itself as a country that exists above the universal rights of everyone else. That said, Guantanamo on its own is a crime against humanity, and there can never be any justification to rationalize why hundreds of people are held indefinitely without trial, without due process, without international observers, and without ever seeing their families and loved ones. The explanation often offered by the pro-Guantanamo pundits is that the prison inmates are dangerous men. If that was indeed the case, why were these supposed criminals not allowed to see their day in court? According to a report by Amnesty International published in May 2020, of the 779 men who were taken to that facility, only 7 have been convicted. Worse, 5 of them were convicted as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty in return for the possibility of release from the base. According to the rights group, such a trial by military commission did not meet fair trial standards. In other words, Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry, and a lucrative one. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system. Referring to the unjust justice system, Human Rights Watch derided the U.S. for having the largest reported prison population in the world. HRW stated on its website, the U.S. criminal justice system, from policing and prosecution through to punishment, is plagued with injustices like racial disparities, excessively harsh sentencing, and drug and immigration policies that improperly emphasize criminalization. The above two can be considered an answer to Obama's rhetorical question, is this who we are? Yes, Mr. Obama, in fact, this is precisely who you are. While offering the world's most miserable detention conditions to hundreds of potentially innocent men, Guantanamo also offers career opportunities, high military perks and honors, and a seemingly endless budget for a small army to guard only a few shackled, gaunt-looking men in a faraway land. So even if Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut Guantanamo down, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its mistakes.